We think of the future as open to possibility, unknown, the future as fluid state. The past we see as settled, fixed, beyond change, beyond possibilities. In some fairly important ways, though, the past is as fluid as is the future, and as uncertain. I'm Susan McGinnis for Conversations. Today, an hour with archaeologist Jim Dixon. His new book is called Quest. Jim, we've come to understand in fairly graphic ways that the recent past, which many thought to be a single history, really is open to historical perspective. Perhaps the picture that comes immediately to mind is most all of the history books citing Columbus's discovery as the beginning of American history, and in recent times we have acknowledged that there was a long prehistory, so to speak, a long history prior to Columbus. We can also take a look at histories to discover that there are women's histories, African American histories, Chinese American histories, Native American histories. What is so about immediate history is very much so about prehistory. Is that true? Is my opening assertion correct?
Well, I think so. Certainly the philosophers of history have devoted a lot of time to this sort of thinking. And really, history is what we perceive it to be and what facts we choose to present and interpret. And it changes with our social mores and our social attitudes of the present day. So a history written in 1880 would be very different than a history written in 1980 and so forth.
How about prehistory? Does our view of what happens in what happened in the long historical record have anything to do with perception?
Well, certainly, I think that prehistory, even maybe more so than written history, because we're certainly beyond the range of historical written documentation, and we use a variety of scientific techniques to interpret the past. And as the rapid technological developments of our times, so things like radiocarbon dating and various biochemical analyses and so forth, have entered the technological arena for interpretation, we've been able to interpret the past with greater chronological accuracy, as well as provide different insights and interpretations to the events of the past.
When we take a look at Alaska, are we looking at a fairly ripe ground for examination and discovery when you're thinking about our long history, or are we looking at one that has few clues?
Well, I think that up until probably the early 1900s, there was virtually nothing known about the archaeology of Alaska. But now, of course, we've got a tremendous body of data that's been accumulated and more coming in every day. And it's quite clear that Alaska is one of the central points in the world in terms of understanding human interaction and behavior, because it's clearly a point of exchange between the old world or Asia and North America. Even before the times of the Bering Land Bridge, or after the times of the Bering Land Bridge, people certainly traveled across Bering Strait, and some of the great technological inventions of the world, I'm sure, were exchanged across that narrow area.
What do we know about those people?
Well, they're, I think clearly over time it's been revealed that it's a far more complex world in the past than we had originally thought. When you have very little data, it's very easy to interpret it. As you accumulate more and more information, you realize there's greater diversity, greater time depth, and greater variation in the behavior of peoples in the past.
What was the old picture?
Well, traditionally, we've looked at the peopling of the Americas, the original colonization of the Americas, as coming out of Asia across the Bering Land Bridge during the Pleistocene or Ice Ages, and people spreading southward from Eastern Beringia, or the area that's now Alaska and Yukon Territory, into the more southern areas of North America and then into South America, and colonizing the continents probably by about 11,000 years ago.
Just is the picture of a one-way ticket? These people came across, never wandered back, only came across in a given period of time?
Well, it's I think that's pretty naive, and I think most contemporary archaeologists would think so. There have probably been several waves of influence from Asia into the Americas, and probably waves of influence from the Americas back to Asia. The archaeological picture on the Asian side is a little more obscure than it is on the Alaskan side, I think, because there's just been a little bit less research done there, and it's been obfuscated in the past by the Soviet government's lack of sharing this information with us.
Mm-hmm. This is Jim Dixon talking to us today on Conversations. His new book, published by the University of New Mexico Press in spring of 1993, is called Quest. Its full title, Quest for the Origins of the First Americans. Jim Dixon is the curator of archaeology for the University of Alaska Museum, located here on the University of Alaska Fairbanks campus. What do you mean by waves of influence? These people just didn't travel. They had impact, yes?
Well, yes. Certainly the one of the hypotheses is that the very first humans to arrive in the Americas brought about the extinction of many large Pleistocene animals, for example, the woolly mammoth and not-so-woolly mammoth further to the south, various forms of extinct bison and horse, camel, other species that were quite prevalent at that time.
Hunted them to death?
Yes, that's one of the hypotheses anyway. And there's an uncanny correlation between the time of extinction of these animals and the earliest archaeological evidence about 11,300 years ago. I guess other aspects of influence could be subsequent major technological changes in the types of tools that people made in the past. We can clearly see that happening in the archaeological record possibly as early as 10,500 years ago, maybe 10,600 years ago, depending on how you interpret the chronology. Whether this is an actual movement of peoples or whether it's an actual diffusion or dissemination of technological concepts, it's difficult to say.
Yeah. I want to back up to the hunting extinction or the forced extinction of such a number of species of animals. The question mark in my mind has to do with the numbers of people at that time, their drive, their hunger level, and the numbers of mammoth, bison, and other animals that may have been forced into extinction?
Yes, the major proponent of this Pleistocene overkill hypothesis was is Paul Martin, who was a very prominent paleoecologist. And he suggests that as humans entered the Americas, they pursued these animals and brought them to extinction. And one of the concepts he has put forward is kind of a what he calls a wave front. In other words, on the very leading edge of this population movement, the population would have been greater because there would have been greater resources because these species were not extinct. And this allowed humans to expand rather rapidly all the way from Alaska, what's today Alaska, all the way to the tip of South America, Tierra del Fuego, within a few hundred years. And he's done a very elaborate and sophisticated computer model of this, and it certainly is mathematically possible. I couldn't give you the exact statistics here at the moment, but it, logically it's quite eloquent and certainly plausible.
What do you think about this thought that we ate our way to South America?
Well, it's certainly has some merit. I think that it's whether it's right or wrong, it's done a great deal to stimulate research and thinking on the subject. And I think Paul Martin himself would agree that that he really doesn't care what the answer is. He just wants to know what it is, and he would also like to see these concepts tested in the field.
There is intellectual excitement in the promotion of and then the arguments surrounding a new theory about history, is there not?
Oh, certainly. And when these things are introduced at academic meetings and so forth, the debate can be quite heated and quite exciting. Yeah.
Tell me what Eastern Beringia, what we know of as Alaska, looked like during the Pleistocene. Can you do that? I think there are people who will simply not know.
Yeah, well, that's a very tall order, and I certainly don't have all the answers. The research is ongoing, and it'll be many years before we have a complete picture. But at the close of the Ice Ages, Alaska and Asia were joined as a single landmass called Beringia, and Eastern Beringia is that portion that was not glaciated or was ice-free in Alaska and adjacent Yukon Territory. The current thinking, I think, if you had to take a consensus, would be that the environment was drier at that time, during the Pleistocene, grassier. There were no forests in the region at all, and the area supported more grazers or species that supported themselves by feeding on grass as opposed to shrubs or trees.
Did we have seasons as we think of them here? Were there harsh winters and pleasant springs, hot summers?
Yeah, so there's one theory. There's a number of Pleistocene sand dunes around the state of Alaska, and Dave Hopkins, who is our distinguished a professor of quaternary science here at the university, has hypothesized that this was a time of greater winds, creating less snow cover so that these grazers could actually get to their feed, and also a drier climate with areas that were more sparsely vegetated, allowing these sediments to move around and be blown by the winds. By about 10,000 years ago, the Bering Land Bridge had flooded for the last time Asia and North America were separated, and the ice sheets had retreated considerably. By possibly early as 9,000 years ago, the trees began to spread into the area, and probably all Pleistocene, what we call megafauna, or the large species of mammoth and so forth, had become extinct, possibly much earlier than that.
Once again, this is Jim Dixon. He is with us from the University of Alaska Museum. He is a professor of archaeology and, as I've said, the curator of archaeology for the University of Alaska Museum here at UAF. I'm Susan McGinnis. You're listening to Conversations. You tell on the very first, if not the first page of your book, a story of a chilly midnight. You and your son went whitefish spearing. And you said, as you were reminiscing on this trip, we were fishing in much the same manner as prehistoric people had fished. Is that so? Can I imagine you and your son going out at midnight 11,000 years ago? What would you look like? What would you wear? Would you be looking for whitefish?
Well, I think to a degree that what I said there is true. Yes, we know that spearing was one of the major ways of taking fish in the prehistoric past. We found what are called Leister prongs in the archaeological record. These are the prongs used on fish spears. This is a technique that persisted right up to historic times. And yes, prehistorically, people probably fished much the same way. We certainly have the archaeological evidence for it. We've got the tools and the fish bones.
And the fish then were fish now. The fish now were fish then.
Well, yes. The okay. Same species were around. Every species that is extant today was alive during the Pleistocene. What's happened is that the today's fauna is relatively impoverished and that some of those species have died out. But things like caribou and all the fish species and so forth existed at that time.
When you say it's impoverished, you just mean there's not the variety that
there
was.
There are fewer species today than there were during the Pleistocene.
Okay. Do you expect that what you did on that chilly evening would have happened? You would have gone out at the night time because that's the best time to spear whitefish?
Yes, I think so.
I'm looking for a picture of the times. What did it...
Well, it's hard to say because the preservation is so poor, and archaeologists really don't recover events. They recover the material remains of events. So what we're really seeing in the archaeological record are things like pieces of rolled birch bark that have been burned on one end, probably used as torches. We probably see needles that were used to make tailored skin clothing and waterproof mukluks, things of that nature. So with a little imagination, you can bridge the gap between the remains, material cultural remains, and the actual events of the past.
Mm-hmm. And can that imagination take you in directions that you find later you wished you hadn't gone?
Well, of course.
You tell a story a little later in the book about Charles Bonnell and Otto Geist, the beginnings of taphonomy. Can you retell that story, how certain assumptions were made based on what was held in the hand that probably were not so?
Yes. As most Fairbanksons know, that during the 1920s and 30s, there were a massive removal of what we call the muck deposits around here in the vicinity of Fairbanks. And these are actually massive columns or sediments of Pleistocene silts that contained the bones of Pleistocene animals. Many of these deposits were frozen, leading to excellent organic preservation. And as the gold dredges advanced, the sediment would be removed because it was regarded as overburden over the gold-bearing gravels. And as it was removed, literally thousands of bones of Pleistocene animals came out of these muck deposits. Unfortunately, when they came out of kind of in a jumbled, soupy, gooey mess that no one could really determine exactly where the bones had come from originally, whether one bone was associated with another. And occasionally, artifacts came out of these deposits, legitimate bona fide artifacts that anyone would recognize, bone spear points or projectile points of some kind, and occasionally a stone tool as well. In the process of this, many bones of extinct animals came out that appeared to have been worked by humans. And these caught the imagination of Otto Geist and Charles Bonnell. And they wrote back to Charles Frick and other individuals at the American Museum of Natural History in New York, saying that they believed that these were artifacts produced by humans. We know now that there are equally, if not more plausible, non-cultural explanations for the way these bones look. But they did make an imaginative leap between the morphology of these bones and human behavior, really.
And what they looked at was that a bone looked to be carved in some way. When you say worked, carved, or
yeah, these bones were many of them were fractured in ways that looked like they may have been struck by humans with stone tools to flake them. Actually, like you would flake a stone tool. Some of them had striations and polish on them that looked like they had been used in a certain systematic fashion by humans. We know now that animals can produce many of these types of fractures and striations and polish, as well as geologic agents such as sediment moving over a bone to polish it or facet it in certain ways that resemble human behavior.
It makes it quite complicated that what you look at and the logic that you have don't necessarily match.
Yes, you know, working in a museum, I see this all the time. People bring in every imaginable curiosity, which they believe has been produced by humans, sometimes including rocks that look like clay tablets and this sort of thing. And the truth of the matter is nature can create a wide variety of objects that resemble things that are made by humans.
You quote a geologist named Schaller as saying, the pitfall of the unwary.
Mm-hmm.
He said, if you go to a site looking for human artifacts, you're going to find so many it will be most embarrassing and instructive.
Yes, right.
Is this a problem of archaeology, that you will go down a path only to discover that that path wasn't a path at all and have to backtrack and go down another?
Well, I don't know if it's a problem of archaeology or unique to archaeology. I think that all science has similar experiences, that a certain line of inquiry may look promising or reasonable at a certain point in time, and then as you pursue it and advance certain hypotheses that are tested, you realize that either it's correct or it isn't, and if you're smart, you stop and find another route to pursue.
I'm interested in a research project that you engaged in with a man named Loy, which you talk about in the book Quest. This is one where you... Is this not incorrect to say? Is this correct to say you're hoping to create a new path to discovery? You're using a new research technology and some assumptions about the past that are new?
Yes, I think so. Actually, I shouldn't take much credit for this. It's really Tom Loy has been the leading researcher in this area, and it's been quite controversial, I might add. Anytime you introduce a new technique, everyone is very skeptical, and rightfully so. But what Tom has done is he's been able to do is recognize that preserved on stone tools are various residues resulting from when they were used in the prehistoric past, and that these residues are preserved for thousands of years, maybe longer.
What might be a residue?
Well, for example, a projectile point, or let's say an arrowhead or a spearhead that's been used to kill an animal. If that's been inside the animal, it gets drenched in blood, possibly picking up little bits of tissue, muscle tissue or bone or sinew, that when dried on that specimen, then is preserved for millennia.
It's fascinating, yeah. Actually, to think of this.
I should add, it's not always preserved. It sometimes is, yes.
Uh-huh. And you and Loy thought there is a way to get into that residue, find out what it is, and make certain assumptions about what that was.
Yes. Well, Loy published an article in Science magazine in the mid-1980s, which he documented his ability to remove the residue from these stone tools and identify it as to species using a technique called hemoglobin crystallization, which now I think is regarded as a very subjective method. So his methods have come under quite a bit of fire. But I think that one thing he has really proven is that these residues are there. They are preserved. And something can be done with them. Now the question is, to what degree of accuracy this can be done is another question.
Mm-hmm. Was it important to the theory that each species' blood is distinct? Is that so?
Yes, it is. Every species has, you know, a distinct DNA code, and certainly, when these hemoglobin crystals, which are derived from the blood, are forced to grow, will grow very distinctly for each individual species. This research was done back in the turn of the century in terms of doing research on malaria, where they wanted to see what insects were preying on what species and to control the disease. So basically looking at blood in mosquitoes is how it was originally developed.
Because only certain instincts could carry malarial infected blood.
Right, and they wanted to see what mosquitoes were preying on what segments of the mammalian population, really.
Sure. There were some recent concerns about whether mosquitoes could carry HIV, is that right?
Well, I heard that in the press. Yeah, I don't know anything about it, really.
Sure, but it would be the same kind of question.
Right, yes, exactly.
Okay.
But one unique thing about Loy's work is that it's opened up this whole new frontier of research, and it's clearly become a lot more complicated than we thought it was initially, because unlike a laboratory experiment where you can control all the variables, when he extracts these residues from the stone tools, you have no control over how that residue got on there or what it is. For example, the same tool could have been used to butcher four or five different species of mammals. It may have been used to strip fish scales off of fish and so forth. So combined in this residue is a very complex picture of the use of this particular stone tool, and that can make it very difficult in terms of the analysis. It's far more complex.
Mm-hmm. How do you think it will shake out, or do you think you're still opening windows here?
Yeah, I think what it's done is it's raised the level of awareness of what these tools can what kind of data they can yield. One example is that there's a new radiocarbon dating technique called accelerator mass spectrometry, which can be used to date very minute amount of organic material. So it is possible, theoretically possible, and actually a couple of experimental radiocarbon dates have been done this way already, to actually date the residue, the organic carbon in the residue itself. So actually a stone tool with no contextual information could possibly tell you the age at which it was used and what species it came in contact with in the prehistoric past, a whole new wealth of information that we didn't know existed 10 years ago.
Mm-hmm. Once again, this is our guest today on Conversations, Dr. Jim Dixon. Dr. Dixon earned his Ph.D. in anthropology from Brown University in 1979, his master's and bachelor's both in anthropology in short order from the University of Alaska Fairbanks in 1972 and 1970, respectively. Jim Dixon has been with the University of Alaska Museum and with the University of Alaska Fairbanks since 1975. He is a full professor of anthropology, tenured in 1984, a member of the teaching faculty, as well as curator of archaeology of the University of Alaska Museum. I'm Susan McGinnis. Our guest today has written a book almost before it's out, is going into its second printing, Quest, published by the University of New Mexico Press. Explores the origins of the first Americans. You mentioned earlier in this hour that the people of the past may be more diverse and more complex than first thought. In your book, you talk about both traditions and transitions among early peoples. These are more specific words than we think of in normal use. Can you describe them for me? Again, I'm looking for people who aren't educated in anthropology or archaeology, a picture of earlier times that we can grasp or that may elude us, but that we may have clues to.
Well, I'll try. Archaeologists use the term tradition as a to describe a suite of traits, and these include the technology of a particular group of people during a particular time, their lifestyle, their economic basis, and so forth. And these are compared between specific archaeological sites and defined over broad regions, and they persist over long periods of time, really. So when an archaeologist uses the term tradition, they mean cohesive material culture, in other words, the tools that people use and their lifestyle and their economy, and that persists over a long period of time. And by that, I mean generally thousands of years.
Okay. Now introduce this word transitions, and then maybe we can go back and take a look at some traditions that may have prevailed in our past here in Eastern Beringia.
Well, I'm not sure about transitions. I don't know if I actually used that word. But I think what you're talking about is when one tradition comes to an end and another begins, whether that's a transition between from one group of people just changing their technology and their economy and so forth, or whether it's actual replacement of a group of people by another group of people is a matter of some debate. And we really don't know, at least in this region of the world, what happened, because we have things like language and other things that really define culture are very difficult for archaeologists to extract from the archaeological record.
So this is a supposition.
Well, a transition would imply that there's a kind of a somewhat gradual change in material culture from within one group of people to something else.
Okay, right. What do we know about traditions of people who may have come across the Bering Straits and moved south?
Well, when I was a student, the answer to that question was people came across the Bering Land Bridge possibly as early as 27,000 years ago, slipped down between the massive continental ice sheets through what's called the ice-free corridor, and colonized the rest of the continent. There was really no other answer than that that was acceptable on your exam. If you didn't say that, you failed the test. We know now that it's a lot more complicated than that, and I certainly wouldn't give a student 100% if they answered that only on a test. But we realize that things are a lot more complicated. We expected to find artifacts that are called Clovis-like artifacts in Alaska that were associated with mammoth kill sites that date to about 11,300 years ago in the what we call Lower 48 from here, the more southern areas of North America. It turns out that we have artifacts like that, but although they still remain undated in this area of the world, they don't appear to be as old as the ones in the Lower 48 based on a lot of circumstantial evidence, which I don't want to get into right now. But an important fact is they haven't been found in Asia. And that suggests to many of us that they do not have an Asian origin, but are truly made in America, unique American technology that wasn't derived from Asia.
Why has there been some hesitation to think that things were made in America? Why has it been so compelling to believe that everything emerged from Africa, across Europe, across Asia, only then developing in the United States, what we think of, and in South America?
Well, chronologically, it's very clear that the archaeological sites in Asia are older and in Europe, in the old world, are older than the ones in the Americas. And we certainly have good evidence for mammoth hunting in Asia that predates mammoth hunting in North America. So there is a timeline there where many archaeologists believe that, well, this tradition of mammoth hunting and large game hunting spread out of Asia into the Americas, where it occurred, in fact, did occur later in time.
But why must it be so?
Well, that's a very good question. I think a lot of us started saying, well, gee, you know, that makes sense, but there certainly are other possibilities. And the more discoveries that have been made, primarily here in the interior of Alaska by Roger Powers in the Anthropology Department and Chuck Holmes and David Yesner at the University of Alaska in Anchorage, have revealed artifacts that are contemporaneous with what I called Clovis, or 11,300-year-old examples of mammoth hunters in the southern areas of North America. They're contemporaneous, but they're different, and they come right here from eastern Beringia. So it tells us that at that point in time, by 11,300 years ago, we had similar but different technological traditions in North America. And if the old model were correct, we should have artifacts that are similar to Clovis, or these fluted projectile points, in Alaska, older than Clovis, and then we should have them even older in Asia. And we haven't been able to find them in Asia at all. And the ones we have in Alaska look like they're a little bit younger than this Nenana complex that has been documented.
And if this opens up the realm of possibilities, what does it say to people like you or to people like Roger Powers?
Well, it says a lot of different things to different people. And it's, you know, now we're in the realm of interpretation. I think Roger would suggest that the Nenana complex is a little bit older than Clovis to the south, and that Clovis has evolved or developed from the Nenana complex. And that very well may be true. I suspect that both of them are, if you will, descendants of a common ancestor or variants of even an earlier archaeological tradition that we haven't documented yet. So there are different hypotheses on that, and they're all equally valid. It's just a matter of time until we're able to test them.
Because projectile points are relatively common among artifacts, is the belief that people were predominantly hunters? Are there other possibilities?
Well, there certainly are. In the past, kind of the model has been these big game hunters moving out of Asia across the high latitudes, across Beringia and into the Americas. Recently, a site, an archaeological site here in interior Alaska called the Broken Mammoth Site has been excavated, which has excellent faunal preservation. It's ascribed to this Nenana complex, or the 11,300-year-old interior Alaskan technological tradition. And lo and behold, the faunal remains include numerous bird bones, migratory waterfowl, some fish scale, some bird egg fragments, and so forth. This clearly tells us that people were certainly not hunting only large mammals. There are large mammal remains in that site, but the Broken Mammoth site provides us with a great deal of variety in the economy of these people. And it's very clear that whatever could be harvested on the landscape was probably being harvested, and people were really in tune with the species around them and able to adequately obtain them at a variety of sites and during different times of the year.
There's an archaeologist named Lewis Binford who visited here a while back who argues that our ancestors were probably more like scavengers than like burly hunters. Is there some of that possibility in your mind as well, that we came along after a fight between mammoths or after a fight between bison or one animal attacking and killing another and kind of cleaned up?
Well, I think that's certainly a possibility. I don't believe so, because I think that the indications are that people were exploiting fresh kills. We clearly see fresh butchering marks on these animals, with the Clovis material in the lower 48, or these very early mammoth kill sites and bison kill sites as well, the projectile points are actually within the ribs of the animals that were killed. That tells me that, you know, these weren't scavenged, but they were actually hunted and killed by humans. Now, there may have been some scavenging. I think humans are incredibly resourceful, and in times of famine or hunger, I think that people will resort to about anything that's necessary to survive, clearly. But I think all things being equal, people prefer fresh food, and clearly are capable of taking this wide variety of species, as demonstrated from the bones at the broken mammoth site.
These people were then resourceful. Were they intelligent?
Oh, certainly. I think to survive in this environment, you would have to be. And just the array of species that appear in that particular archaeological site show that people had a great deal of knowledge about the behavior of all of these different animals and how they could be taken at different times of year. That's very important. That tells you that you know, these aren't some kind of hyena-like scavengers going along the landscape feeding off carcasses of wolf kills and so forth, but these are very fully evolved, intelligent human beings that probably had a tremendous knowledge of the natural environment and how to survive in it.
Do you expect that a hunting party went out to bring down a mammoth, that this was a cooperative community effort?
Well, I think that clearly must have been the case. It certainly was the case in the more southern parts of North America. We have no direct evidence of mammoth kill sites in Alaska or anywhere in eastern Beringia. So that's really unknown. We have some mammoth bone that just recently appeared in two archaeological sites here in the interior, but there's a debate whether this bone actually represents the remains of a mammoth that was killed by these hunters, or whether it's bone that was scavenged from animals that were already dead. Some people believe that mammoth may have been extinct already, but their skeletons and tusks were still on the landscape, and people were utilizing these resources. So there's we don't know for sure for this area.
Now I'm confused about the question of human beings having kind of brought mammoths to extinction through this part of the world. If there's no sign of mammoths being killed by human beings, can we be certain of?
No, we can't, of course.
No.
I mean, this is a hypothesis, and it needs to be tested. If the recent archaeological remains are demonstrated to be the evidence of humans hunting mammoths, then we would have an overlap of humans and mammoths of several hundred, possibly 500 to 1,000 years in eastern Beringia. If that's the case, and Tom Loy's blood residue analysis would suggest that too, if that's the case, then clearly humans and mammoths cohabited in eastern Beringia for a considerable period of time without mammoths becoming extinct. And that would certainly, I think, refute the overkill hypothesis, at least for this part of the world. Now, it may not be true for other parts of the world.
Jim Dixon is with us. We're talking about his new book called Quest. His work since 1971 has been funded by and his accomplishments rewarded by grants and awards, allowing him to pursue research within Alaska, in the Soviet Union, as far south as Venezuela, Peru, and Mexico, and to study in Denmark in the early years, and in the middle years to write and do research both in Australia and in Thailand. Recent grants from the National Geographic Society and from the Natural Resources Fund at University of Alaska Fairbanks have supported cave reconnaissance and other prehistory research in southeast Alaska's Tongass National Forest. I'm Susan McGinnis. You're listening to Conversations. There has been some research by two separate scientists in South America that you have found particularly interesting. Can you talk about the cave drawings, the wall paintings in...
Well, I think you're probably thinking of a site called Pedra Ferrada in Brazil, excavated by a French archaeologist, Guidon. However, it's not the paintings that are dated, but there are... Well, there have been some attempts at that too. But the important thing is that she believes that she has discovered archaeological remains in Brazil that date to possibly as early as 33,000 years ago, right up to later times, what we call the Holocene, or the time that we live in now, that followed the Pleistocene. Another archaeologist, Tom Dillahay, who was excavated in Chile at a site called Monteverde, has possibly archaeological material in the 28,000 to 33,000 year range, as well as much later material about 12,500 years ago. I would like to add that this very early archaeological material in the 30,000 year range is very, very controversial, and certainly there's not consensus among archaeologists, including myself, that this is bona fide archaeological remains. However, the later material excavated by Dillahay at about 12,500 years ago is clearly human in manufacture. I don't think that any of us would question that. There's been some controversy over the site because it doesn't fit our traditional models. We'd have to have older sites further north. And he turns up a site at about 1,000 years older than these Clovis hunters we've been talking about in South America. Kind of disrupts the normal paradigm.
And the question in either case is, well, how did they get there from here? Or how did they get there that early?
Well, there's a number of approaches to solving this problem. One is to claim that these sites are not accurately dated and so forth, and there certainly is that school. I think we need to keep our minds open to this, and we don't have the final analysis on that. But one possible explanation for Dillahay's work is that humans may have been able to skirt the northern rim of North America along the coastal fringe of what we've been calling Eastern Beringia, down along the northwest coast of North America, and possibly reaching that part of the world by 12,500 years ago.
Does this mean that Tom Dillahay may think they're traveling by boat?
Or? Well, clearly.
Oh, they are definitely by boat.
That would require watercraft to have that hypothesis ring true. One of the problems is that watercraft are very difficult to discover in the archaeological record because many of these Pleistocene coastal sites have been inundated by sea level rise as the glaciers melted, sea level rose, severing the Bering Land Bridge and flooding much of the coasts of the world. Plus, they're organic in composition and very poorly preserved, no doubt. So the chances of finding a boat in the archaeological record dating thousands of years before present is very, very slim. However, there is evidence from Australia and the South Pacific that shows that islands that were never connected by land were colonized as early as 30,000 to 40,000 years ago. So clearly in the southern hemisphere, people had watercraft by that time. If we can assume similar technological development in the northern hemisphere, I don't think it's unreasonable to propose that people have some kind of substantial watercraft by 12 or 13,000 years ago.
Could they have been taking such a long trip and through such waters that long ago?
Well, there's a Canadian archaeologist, Knut Fladmark, has hypothesized that based on very rudimentary technology that people could travel the entire length of the North and South American continents in about 10 years using non-motorized, very primitive watercraft, really.
So it could be done.
That's certainly possible, yes. I think one thing, too, which has been discovered since I wrote my book, and I wish I had the exact references, but I don't, but there's been an obsidian source discovered in Japan, which is derived from an offshore island, and the obsidian clearly has to be derived from that source. You can tell you can fingerprint an obsidian source based on its composition, so you can tell exactly where it came from. And this offshore island was never connected to Japan during the Pleistocene, and yet the obsidian in the archaeological site dates to about 13,000, 14,000 years ago. So what this tells us is that people had to have boats, at least in the northern hemisphere and in Asia, by that time.
I don't know whether this is a silly question or not. Any chance that people came over from Australia, skipped the Bering Land Bridge entirely and got to South America just by the water?
Well, first I'll preface this by this is a very unpopular line of reasoning. There were great abuses in explaining the cultures of the New World based on diffusion from Asia and Europe and Africa during the very early years of American anthropology. And this was pretty soundly trounced by most researchers. It's certainly possible, and I think we should keep our minds open to that possibility, but there really is no firm evidence except for these very early controversial sites in South America. And when I say early, I'm talking these 30,000-year dates. Until those are really well documented and examined by a variety of professionals, I think that that's very speculative. But it's certainly possible. I think we should keep our minds open to that. But it's far from demonstrated.
Is it? And this may be a matter of speculation for you as well. Do you think it's difficult to keep the candle burning when of a conjecture, of a speculation, when so many in the field tell you that you're not thinking clearly? And I don't mean you specifically, but the woman in Brazil who says, I'm sure these are 30,000-year-old wall paintings. Do you think it's difficult for her to continue on? Difficult others to come to her side?
Yes, I'm sure it's very difficult for her. Probably not as difficult as it would be for an American, someone working in the New World. She's coming from the Old World, from Europe, where dates of this time range are not unusual, and most scholars there would accept that without any problem. However, in the Americas, these dates are very unusual, and I think that there are many scholars in this hemisphere that have really committed their lives research and all their publications and their career really dedicated to the assumption that humans are very late arrivals, and by late I mean 12,000 years ago in the Americas, and are very threatened by these very early radiocarbon dates.
It's interesting that she could probably go home and have an audience for her argument, but here she could kind of risk losing her credential as an anthropologist, archaeologist.
Well, I don't think she'd risk losing her credential, but she would certainly encounter considerable opposition and probably get very stormy reviews on her research proposals and that sort of thing. But I would add that there are a cadre of North American archaeologists that are equally committed and equally vehement about humans being in the Americas prior to 11 or 12,000 years ago. So there is that. There's a little bit smaller, but I think that that group is definitely here. And and it's really the polarity and the debate between these two camps that that make it exciting, I think.
Well, I want to ask you about that. Tell me about the quest. This is the title of your book, and it refers to kind of the seeking of a truth about the origins of the first Americans, but it also refers to something else, which is the thrill of the chase, maybe?
Yeah, or the experience of it. I think I wouldn't use the word truth. I don't know if there's any such thing as ultimate truth, but we try to get at least reasonable answers to questions, and I think the question always gets more complicated and more difficult, and you will never have an ultimate answer to anything, I don't think. But in the pursuit of that question or trying to get these answers, I think we discover many important and fascinating facts and facets, not only about human nature and the human experience on the species level, but also about the natural history of North America, about the behavior of Pleistocene mammoths and all sorts of things.
Has that picture for you changed a great deal since 1970 or so?
Oh, certainly, and I hope it continues to change for my whole life. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What? I'm curious about how you've grown as an archaeologist from your own perspective, what you thought then that you find now you wouldn't think at all.
Yeah, well, I think that one of the things is that aging has clearly indicated that I think you have to keep an open mind. I think that's very important. That's a lesson I've learned. When you're a kind of an aggressive young graduate student, it's nice to think you have all the answers or many of the answers anyway. And the truth of the matter is that knowledge is a very transient thing, and it's you've got to keep pursuing it or you'll be left behind. Secondly, I think that as just the sheer volume of archaeological data have increased over the last several decades, we've realized that the picture is incredibly more complicated than we ever realized. And the number of interpretations are far more diverse than we would have been willing to accept, I think, 20, 30 years ago.
Jim Dixon is our guest today on Conversations. He is the director of the Alaska Quaternary Center, has been so for the last 2 years. He is a co-founder of the Quaternary Center and has served the board 3 two-year terms in addition to being its director presently. The Quaternary Center is a group of scientists from a variety of disciplines at the University of Alaska who share research interests in climate, geology, and prehistory, all having to do with the Pleistocene. Which raises a question for me. How do the various disciplines interact? It seems that your work and scientists in other disciplines' work is informed by anthropology, archaeology, geology. I'm sure there must be more on that list. How does everyone work together? And I suppose one answer would be well or indifferently, but another would be kind of the logistics of of mutual information.
Well, it's that's a very good question, and I think it varies depending on the situation. There are a lot of variables involved in all this, but I think that archaeologists, to interpret archaeological remains accurately, really require the assistance of geologists to interpret the stratigraphy of an archaeological site, to reconstruct the landscape at the time it was occupied, require biologists to help us make behavioral inferences on the various species that are the prey of the people that lived at the sites, and so forth. And, of course, we need a little bit of social theory from anthropology and analogy to other cultures around the world to interpret these physical remains. We also need biochemists to help us interpret some of the biological remains. We need geochemists to help us with the radiocarbon dating and other sorts of things. So it's really a very complex field today. And one is very foolish if they don't approach it on a very interdisciplinary level. And I think that over the last few decades, we've certainly realized the great benefit in doing that. And really, archaeology is one of the few disciplines that can not only incorporate all of these other disciplines in its projects, but also get funding for them through proposal writing, because they are really essential in interpreting the archaeological context.
Is the field just so much richer for having all these disciplines, all these individuals involved now?
Oh, certainly. It's created a far more wide-ranging debate, I think a far more wide-ranging level of understanding and interpretation, and also a greater degree of complexity, I might add, in interpreting an archaeological site. The days of one person going in and excavating a site and coming back with a few hundred stone tools and publishing an article are pretty much over. So I think one really has to be very well equipped and well trained to properly undertake some of these excavations.
Not to mention flexible and open-minded.
Well, yes, hopefully that's always the case.
One always hopes. Jim mentioned grants. His work has been amply supported by research contracts since the 1970s. They have made it possible for him to salvage a large prehistoric Aleut village site in the early years, to investigate the possibility of submerged Aboriginal habitation sites in the Bering Sea, to look for prehistoric village sites around the outer continental shelf in the western Gulf of Alaska, to survey and inventory sites on Fort Wainwright, close to home, and to survey and inventory the Susitna Hydropower Project sites as well. Field work has been done in northern and interior Alaska, south central, the Aleutian Islands, and the Bering Sea in the area of eastern Beringia. This is Conversations. We're talking with author and archaeologist Jim Dixon. All those reasons are good reasons that archaeologists enjoy the input from the various other disciplines. How about the other disciplines? Do they enjoy great benefits from archaeologists as well as from the others around the quaternary field?
Well, that's a very good question. Yes, they do. Archaeologists, in addition to be able to provide funding for these our colleagues, also I think we contribute to their research in many ways. Archaeological sites are great sources of fossil data. We have the mammal remains and other types of things. Artifacts are frequently used to provide dating for geologic features and geologic context. And then I just think that the overall attempt to interpret past landscapes, geologic processes, climate, all of this is really a holistic pursuit that no one discipline can really solve. These questions are bigger than the ability of any single discipline to solve. And by working together, I think we all share a quantity of information that really enhances all of our work and provides a much broader context and understanding for the various almost parochial problems that many of us deal with on a more daily basis. So I think the Quaternary Center has been ideal in bringing about this fertilization between disciplines, not only the data, but also some of the concepts used by one discipline can be adopted by another. And it's been a very worthwhile organization for the University of Alaska and the students.
This is too large a question, but I'm going to toss it at you to see what your first read on it is. What do you feel the value is to the rest of us of this kind of research? When you said one discipline tends to the parochial view because you're looking at the tiny thing, the microblade, the artifact, but the influence of all the disciplines help you see the larger picture as well as all the other parochial views. What do you think that this kind of research does in that way for those of us not in the field?
Well, you know, this is always one of the questions we get is, you know, what is the purpose of this or what is the meaning of what you're doing? And with many academic pursuits, they tend not to be immediately tangible. But I think that the information that we are getting from these archaeological sites and our ability to interpret them, as well as the interdisciplinary approach, provide some important insights into our nature as human beings. For example, we've been talking about Pleistocene extinctions, whether humans actually brought about the extinction of Pleistocene mammals, not only in North America, but throughout the world. This argument really spills over into contemporary society and human impact on the environment, such things as global warming induced by CO2 emissions and so forth. Humans, the actual nature of man and humans in the environment. I think that we need to understand ourselves in a deep historical perspective. Is it really true that we are responsible as a species for the extinction of all of these mammals that have been going on since we as a species began to evolve during the Quaternary, really? We need to know these answers, or whether we're just so egotistical that we think we're bringing about these extinctions. Mm-hmm. What is really the truth there? And not that there'll ever be an ultimate answer, but I think that we'll get a very good understanding of ourselves by viewing these problems.
If we know, let us say this becomes true, that we've caused in our prehistory the extinction of species of animals, and we know that our behavior in the past 400 or 500 years has caused damage to the environment that may be irreversible, what then? What does that tell us about ourselves, that we're immutably damaging, that this is what we do, this is our nature, or that, boy, we've been doing this for a long time, we better change our ways quick?
Well, humans are very adaptable, and I would certainly hope that we would demonstrate our incredible ability to change and adapt to a new set of circumstances. If not, we may go the way of the mammoth. We'll just have to see.
What does that tell you about human beings? Or what's your sense of human beings, that we've always been good, bad, and indifferent as a species in terms of our living on this earth?
Well, I don't really like terms good and bad, because that really places values on what a species does. And, you know, is a tiger good or bad? You know, I mean, that's really, I think, kind of a red herring. I think one thing that we can certainly see from the deep historical, prehistoric record is the incredible ability of humans to adapt, expand their range, beginning in Africa all the way out across Asia to Australia, the islands of the Pacific, to the Americas. We have colonized every portion of this globe, with the exception of Antarctica. Well, we've done that recently. And we've adapted every environment that exists on this planet. And I think that really tells us a lot about ourselves and our ability to change and to explore. I think there's something innate in human nature that almost demands that.
You're about to make a big change yourself.
Well, yes. I'm retiring from the university at the end of the semester, and I'm moving to the Denver Museum of Natural History, where I'll be curator of archaeology there, working on many of the same problems I've been working on here, just in a different environment. And certainly have not given up my research interests or love for Alaska. That's will always be with me.
Excited about the new step?
Yeah, I certainly am, and I think that that museum has been one of the leaders historically in documenting the extinction of the association of humans and extinct Pleistocene fauna, and has a rich, long history of research in the kind of the areas that I'm interested in. So I'm really looking forward to it.
This has been an hour's discussion with E. James Dixon, the author of Quest for the Origins of the First Americans. This book, available locally, is going into its second printing. The first printing was snapped up actually in part by the Natural Science Book Club, which took all the remaining hardback copies out of circulation just in the last 2 weeks. Still, the book is findable. Look for it, The Quest, by James Dixon, published by the University of New Mexico Press. I'm Susan McGinnis. This has been Conversations. I hope you join me again next week, and thanks a lot to you, Jim Dixon.
Well, thank you.